These are your questions, folks. There's a lot of them.
Sam, are you coming here?
There's a number of questions that are directed to the Site Evaluation Committee. I'm going to take those first. These are questions that would seem to be only directed to the Site Evaluation Committee, but if I change my mind and there's an answer to be had from the company, I will let you know, Mr. Quinlan. The first one, the question says, there seems to be some recent controversy about the Forest Society and its donors on an issue involving the balsams. Will the Site Evaluation Committee require that groups like the Forest Society and Say No to Northern Pass disclose who finances their activities? There is no general requirement that any intervener disclose who finances their activities. That doesn't mean that if there is a dispute over whether or not a entity can participate in the proceeding, that that information may not become relevant or may become relevant. But in general, there's no specific rule that says that a person or a company or an organization that wants to intervene has to reveal where it gets its finances. The next question for the Site Evaluation Committee is there an explanation as to why Counsel for the Public's letter raising concerns about the completeness of the application filed the day before the application was determined to be complete, why did it not appear on the Site Evaluation Committee's website for several days when filings submitted afterwards from other parties appeared sooner? The only answer that I have for that is we don't know the reason why. We received a lot of filings right at that time, and we apologize that they didn't come in, that they didn't get put up on the website in the order in which they came in. But it was, there's no specific reason why that happened, and it wasn't meant to happen that way. The next question involves intervener status. Please explain the intervener process in detail, the petition requirements. Assume a petition is a petition to intervene, I assume the questioner is asking, is accepted. Please explain step by step after acceptance. Must an intervener appear before the committee, or can the committee accept written testimony? What is the time required for review, and any suggestions on what works best? I can't give you legal advice. I do recommend to folks who can afford it, if you are going to try to intervene in the process, it is always better to hire legal counsel than not, and you certainly are entitled to have a lawyer if you intervene in the process. However, I can tell you that in order to file a petition, in order to get a petition granted to intervene, you must demonstrate that you have a right, a claim, or a substantial interest in the outcome of the proceeding, and that it's in the interest of justice for you to participate, and that your participation will not impair the orderly conduct of the proceedings. If you submit a petition that satisfies those three requirements, your petition should be granted. Once your petition is granted, you'll have the same rights and responsibilities of any other party in the proceeding. That means that you will have to identify your witnesses by whatever deadline is set for doing that. It means that you will have to submit pre-filed testimony and any motions that you might have by whatever deadlines are set. You must object to motions by whatever the deadlines are, and you must comply with the committee's rules, and those rules are available on our website. The next part of the question must the intervener appear before the committee? It's a hard question to answer because I can't imagine a circumstance in which, if you actually went through the intervention process, why you wouldn't want to appear before the committee. Because remember, during the adjudicative phase, interveners have the right to cross-examine witnesses and put on their own witnesses. So it wouldn't really make a lot of sense to intervene just to submit written testimony, because the Site Evaluation Committee accepts written testimony right up until the time of their deliberations. So could you become an intervener and move to be excused from actually being at the hearings? Yes, you could probably file a motion to do that. It just doesn't, from the way we normally operate, I don't know why somebody would. And what is the time required for review? The time frames were on the screen up there. The adjudicative portion of the process will occur between day 240, I forget what the actual date was, sometime in August, I believe, and day 365. That will be really the time frame where if you intervene and you're going to participate fully, that's the time frame where your presence is going to be most required. I hope that answers the question. Yes, sir.
Can I add something?
Absolutely. Peter, if you want to add. I don't have a microphone for you, Cui. Thank you.
Can't touch you. Got cooties.
You can take that page.
No, it's okay. This is a place where I can provide some information and insight without providing anybody legal advice. But intervention is really important, and I would encourage anybody who has an interest to do it. And it's not as hard as he just made it sound. And the committee is actually fairly liberal about allowing people to intervene, and the formalities of doing it are pretty simple. All you do is you need to write a letter and explain why, a few reasons why you think it's a good idea. I think it's really important, and I would advise everybody who wants to do this to obtain counsel. And if you can't afford counsel, no one will be appointed for you. And I cannot represent you, but I can provide you some information and guidance as the process rolls along. It's a fairly typical thing for groups of people who are similarly situated to band together and intervene as a group. You know, for example, the Pemigewasset Riverkeepers group or the Smith Street residents or whatever group you want to put together, come in as a group and file either a joint request to intervene or file your own separate intervention requests and then join together and participate together. As far as submitting testimony, it's if you submit testimony, then you really need to be part of the process, and that means you have to be subjected to cross-examination during the hearing. Now, that said, person who puts themselves out to be cross-examined and submit testimony, that's going to, in my humble opinion, gets more weight than someone who stands up and gives unsworn commentary at a hearing. Not that those aren't important, but the weight of a person who actually testifies and sits for cross-examination from these guys is and from me is actually that's a courageous thing to do and shows a great deal of commitment, and it will get a lot of attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. The next question deals with, it asks, will the SEC seek information from other states that also have major transmission projects being planned? And it gives some examples: Plains and Eastern Clean Line in Oklahoma, Transwest Express in Wyoming, Sunzia Southwest in Arizona, and Great Northern Transmission Line. There is no requirement that the Site Evaluation Committee consider projects being planned in other places. However, that doesn't mean that they're never considered. It depends upon what the issues are that come up, and sometimes the way in which an issue has been dealt with in another jurisdiction or another state does indeed become relevant. In large part, that's up to the parties to the proceeding to bring those things to the attention of the Site Evaluation Committee. As you know, the Site Evaluation Committee has one employee, that's Ms. Monroe, and it only sits when there are applications before it. The answer to the question really is, it depends. And I think the last question is just for the SEC is, I am an Eversource employee, but I am not directly involved in a Northern Pass project. How do we ensure that our interests are considered by the Site Evaluation Committee? Doesn't make a difference whether you're Whether you're wearing an orange shirt or whether you're an Eversource employee, everybody has equal standing before the committee and the equal rights to use all of those public participation measures that I went through previously in our presentation. You can provide written comment. You can come to public meetings and public hearings and speak from the dais or ask questions. You can, if you have an interest, you can move to intervene. The fact that you happen to work for one company or a different company makes no difference. You have the same rights as everybody else before the Site Evaluation Committee. The first group of questions for the applicant that we've organized into generally, because some of them have more than one question and they may get off out of categorization.
Can I just respond to that employee question? Because that's not one we've gotten before.
Sure.
I just wanted to, whoever submitted that, thank them for, first of all, taking time to be here tonight. I see many familiar faces out in the audience, so I do appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be here. And I know there are 1,500 of you out there, and I do think our employees are an important voice on this matter. So I think Attorney Iacopino just mentioned some of the ways to formally get involved. It sounds like this employee is not involved on Northern Pass. I think you understand the importance of this project and the opportunities it creates for our employees to get involved in some really exciting work. So thank you for that question. Thanks for being here and for your engagement.
Okay, Mr. Quinlan, the first group of questions that we're going to address deal with the route, the right-of-way, and it looks like some environmental issues. First question is, does Northern Pass, in its consideration of permanent impacts to wetlands, consider the functions and values of the wetlands they are impacting when calculating mitigation ratios as part of their mitigation plan?
Okay. I'm going to introduce Lee Carboneau, who's one of our environmental experts. Lee? She's with Normando.
Yes, thank you, Bill. Lee Carboneau with Normando Associates. So when we evaluate the impact, the permanent impacts to wetland areas, we do consider, and we have categorized these wetland impacts by their principal and other functions and values for every wetland that's impacted. We've done this. That information is in our application materials. We have a big table at the end of our wetland resource report, and it has every wetland with every impact and all of the functions and values that are identified. In calculating what the actual area of impact is for mitigation purposes, every wetland, regardless of its functions and values, is included in that. So even a very low-functioning wetland that has minimal wetland functions and values is treated equally. They are all included in the calculation of wetland impacts. Where the functions and values become important is how we determine what is appropriate mitigation for those impacts. So if the bulk of the impacts are related to good wildlife habitat, if that's what most of the wetland functions are, then we will try and identify mitigation opportunities that highlight wetland mitigation functions of wildlife habitat. So all of the wetlands are included in the calculations, but the functions and values are important in determining what kind of mitigation we do.
Thank you.
The next question, Mr. Quinlan, is will all towers, on the existing right-of-way have a fall zone within the boundaries of the right-of-way?
So I'm going to refer that to Sam Johnson. Sam is one of our project engineers. He's from Burns & McDonald. And also, I'll introduce Jim Munz, who's the president of our transmission business.
So the answer to that is that all of the structures are designed to follow the National Electric Code, and they're specifically designed such that tower failure will happen in almost all instances within the right-of-way itself.
Next question is, why is the proposal for such a high voltage line? Is it correct that the need for the height of the transmission towers is directly related to the voltage?
Again, I'm going to refer that question to Sam and Jim.
The answer is yes. The higher the voltage, typically the higher the structures have to be. And the reason for that is that you have to have clearances between the conductor at its lowest point to the ground. Coupled with that, structure heights are often dictated by the topography of the land. Again, you need to maintain the clearances. And again, that's also designed per the National Electric Code.
The next sheet has three questions on it. First one is, what percentage of New Hampshire electric needs does the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant provide?
You know, Seabrook is, I believe, a 1,200 megawatt station. I think it was recently upgraded. You'd have to ask the owner of that station as to, you know, what portion of that power is used to serve load in New Hampshire. I don't know with whom they've contracted, whether that's even being used to serve customers in New Hampshire or whether it's serving customers in Maine or Massachusetts. That's really a question that I can't answer. Seabrook, again, is a 1,200 megawatt plant, a little bit larger than Northern Pass. Northern Pass is just under 1,100 megawatts.
Okay. The next question on this sheet is, what comparison is there between Eversource and New England Clean Power Link?
Could you repeat that question?
Northern Pass project. What comparison is there between Eversource and New England Clean Power Link?
At a high level, you know, for those of you not familiar with New England Clean Power Link, that's a project proposed by a developer in Vermont. It's similar in size. It's 1,090 megawatts. I'll say a couple of points of differentiation. Obviously, we're not in Vermont. We're in New Hampshire. We're in the process of working with our partner, Hydro-Quebec, on siting an interconnection that essentially would deliver power to the U.S. border. So the generation, the hydro sources, are not at the border. They're further north in Canada. So there's actually a project being sited and that will be built in Canada by our partner to deliver power that could then flow onto the Northern Pass line. I'm not aware of a similar project being sited to deliver power to the New England Clean Power Link. I'll say another perhaps point of differentiation is not only is Hydro-Quebec our partner building that line, they also have entered contracts with us to deliver power into New England through our line. I don't know everything about the New England Clean Power Link, but just from the media coverage of it, I don't know what their power supply is, and I'm not aware of a line being sited in Canada.
And the third question on the sheet is, what upgrades will be made to the existing lines between Deerfield and Ayer, Massachusetts?
Sam or Jim?
Yeah, so the impacts of Northern Pass on other upgrades are actually only between Deerfield and Scobie Pond. The extension of that down to any Massachusetts location is not part of this project. The upgrades that will happen are 10 structures within the 343 structures that are in that corridor will be raised approximately 5 feet.
Next question is, what are you going to do when the new power lines overstep the right-of-way and or if there is no right-of-way set up?
I'm not sure I understand that question,
okay.
But
so the project itself is designed to stay within the existing right-of-way corridor. There will be no places where the design is outside of the corridor at all. So the 100% of the project will be maintained within the existing right-of-way.
So my question, I'm here just to say that you guys are, there's a landowner in northern New Hampshire who owns, 500 acres of land, and you guys are going to come just build that line right on his land. had no intention of selling to you guys, and there's where the problem lies.
Thank you, sir. If you want to make a statement, please fill out a card, and you can make a statement at the time.
Yeah, Ross, what? Very good.
Thank you.
I will say, just to follow up on that point, you know, not only are we staying with within our existing rights of way, but you know, the land rights necessary for this project have been secured, and that's part of our SEC filing.
You know, we've throughout our meetings so far this year, everybody's been very courteous, and I hope that this body, the public here today, will remain courteous as well. The next question really goes to the SEC. It's regarding environmental impact and asks, will you consider only the impact in New Hampshire, or will the impact at the source in Canada be part of your consideration? If this is not a prior consideration, can we ethically discuss one end of the project without addressing the repercussions we would be contributing to at the origin of the project? The answer is that by statute, the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee will consider the benefits and impacts of the project in the state of New Hampshire, and will not likely consider impacts in Canada or in other jurisdictions. Now, it doesn't mean that there might not be some discussion or some consideration of that, but I previously went over with you the Section 16 of RSA 162H, and those are the statutory requirements that the Site Evaluation Committee is required to consider, and those are the consider, and they don't include anything outside of the state of New Hampshire. So that's the best answer that I can give you to that question. The next series of questions deal with burying the burial of the proposed power line. The first question states that the Appalachian Mountain Club continues to oppose the project, but isn't it true that the route modifications, including burial of the line in the entire White Mountain area, eliminates any view impacts in that region?
Yes, that is true. You know, as I said earlier, late in 2015, before we moved into the siting process, we made the commitment to 52 miles of additional underground construction, largely based on feedback from groups such as this. You know, prior to making that decision, we had met with many groups across the state, had gotten a lot of feedback on the importance of that White Mountain National Forest area, including Franconian Notch, the Appalachian Trail, et cetera, and that was consistent, almost irrespective of where you were in the state of New Hampshire and who you were talking to. The first thing we heard about was the impact on the White Mountain National Forest. That's what drove that decision to go with underground construction. That was not an easy decision for us to make. As a result of that, we had to reduce the project size by about 15%. We probably added several hundred million dollars worth of construction costs to the project, and it was all intended to address view impacts in and around the White Mountain National Forest area.
Next question is, Northern Pass says that it listens to the people of New Hampshire. I have two questions, and there are two questions here. Northern Pass buried 8 miles through Clarksville and Stortstown. Why? Is it because the Connecticut Lakes Headwater Land Trust would not allow Northern Pass to go through their land? I'm going to give you a second question, too, because it's similar. Northern Pass buried 35 miles through the White Mountain National Forest. Why? Is it because Northern Pass could not go through the National Forest with towers? And then the questioner writes, has Councillor Ray Burton said before he passed away, quote, bury the entire line through this beautiful state or pick up your tent and go home?
So
the questions are regarding the 8 miles in Clarksville and Stortstown, and 35 miles, according to the questioner, in White Mountain National Forest.
So I'll answer the second question first, and then I'll refer the first question to Mr. Munz, who was here when that earlier decision was made. But as to the decision in and around the White Mountain National Forest, You know, one thing to, so everyone's clear, we have an existing transmission right-of-way with an existing transmission line running through the White Mountain National Forest. So the previous proposal was to use that existing corridor running parallel to that existing line. We determined not to do that. It wasn't because we couldn't do it. We have all the legal rights and property rights necessary to do it. We made that decision to move out of the White Mountain National Forest to minimize view impacts. And as I said, it resulted in almost a 20% reduction in the size of this project, and therefore the benefits of this project, and several hundred million dollars of additional cost. Not because we couldn't do it, because based upon feedback from New Hampshire, we determined not to do it. Okay? So that was the decision around the White Mountain National Forest. And Jim, the earlier decision around the 8 miles in the North Country.
Yeah, the initial, the Jim Muntz, President of Transmission of Eversource. The earlier decision about the 8 miles, it was an initial reaction to the feedback we got about the north 40 miles of this project where there was no right-of-way, there was no transmission line already. As we looked at securing the 22 miles in the Wagner Forest, the other 8 miles became something that underground became the best option for us to establish a control of a route and have a viable project going forward. So that's basically how that came about.
Yeah, and just to round out that answer, because I wasn't here then, but I do know a little bit of background. Not only did we commit to 8 miles of underground construction, as I said earlier, we moved that whole new right-of-way section in the North Country to the east to get it away from view impacts and to get it into this timber forest area. Okay, so that was a combination decision. Going underground was our way of getting to the eastern part of the state.
Okay, next question is a lengthy one. In 2013, Vermont asked Hydro-Quebec to put lines under Lake Champlain and the highway interstate. It was agreed to. Why is this? What is happening in Vermont that is not happening in New Hampshire? States must be respected in the same way. Our livelihoods will be affected in the same way. There are old railroad beds and a river long where these lines should be, riverbed long where these lines should be buried in New Hampshire. Then a bike path from Concord to Colebrook could be built for the citizens. P.S., your company gives out false info. 80% of the lines are not being buried. It is only one-third of the lines. Several questions in there. I should take a crack.
Yeah, now I'll refer the later question, I guess it's the first part of that question, to Mr. Muntz, but the 80% refers to either underground or an existing right-of-way. Okay, we recognize it's about a third that is underground, so 60 miles is underground. The 80% figure is the combination of that plus portions of the route that are an existing right-of-way running parallel to an existing transmission line. Okay, just so we're clear.
Okay. For the first part, I think for clarification, I would suggest that the state of Vermont has not talked to Hydro-Quebec about that. The project proposed in the state of Vermont is by a transmission developer that said, hey, we're going to run a line from Canada down to here. And people are free to propose those type of projects. That type of project is basically a merchant transmission project where they need to get a supply on one end of the line and customers on the other and have an agreement between those two that will cover the cost of the line. And that's the business they're in. That's how they make money. They've proposed a line. To date, we're not aware of who their customers are or who their power supply is. So really doesn't have anything to do with state of Vermont and Hydro-Quebec, to our knowledge. Basically, that developer has asked the state of Vermont for permission to run that line, and we'll see how that evolves as we proceed.
Any other questions about that?
What's your question, sir?
There was an article recently, in the last few days, about the New England stated that state of Vermont has just approved them to build that. And it is also going to be buried in Lake Champlain, as well as underground, after it gets perked at the end of Lake Champlain into the bottom of Vermont to connect up to the grid.
Okay. Why don't we let Mr. Quinlan give you his best answer that he can about that project? If you could explain, please, because there's a lot of questions about this Vermont project.
Yeah, so. That is true. This developer that I've talked about has made that proposal to Vermont, and they've received approval to do it. Now, you know, if that was us, we'd say we need to know who's going to, you know, buy the product from the line, who's going to put the energy into the top part of the line, if you will, and we also need to know what contractors are going to build that line for, you know, the price, for the right price, such that, you know, the money works out and people, you know, make a return on their investments. Those are all questions that are not clear about the Vermont line. Many merchant transmission lines are proposed around the country. The success rate of those from, you know, announcement to siting is very low. Okay, so I would also offer that the same developer has a line that is approved to run from Canada down to New York. That's been approved and has had all its permits for several years. That's advertised as a $2 billion line. Nobody's building it because there's nobody willing to pay for it. There's no contractors that seem to be willing to build it for what, you know, certainly for $2 billion. We've talked to a lot of contractors as part of getting ready for this project, and there's also no supply identified for that project. So those are the ingredients you need to have a successful transmission project. We have a supply. You know, we have customers in New England. We have someone willing to pay for it. So we feel like this application has much more chance of success than a merchant line.
Okay, the next question is three questions on one sheet. Sir, if you want to make a statement, please fill out a card. I've allowed you to stand up and make a question out of line. You could have wrote it down on a sheet. You can still do that if you'd like. But we do need to move on. There's a lot of people who have asked questions here, and we want to get them all answered to the best of our ability. The next sheet has three questions on it. The first one is, what is your basis for saying that Franconia Notch is off limits for burying the line? Have you consulted with all of the parties involved, New Hampshire DOT, New Hampshire DRED, Society for Protection of New Hampshire Forests, Appalachian Mountain Club? If not, why not? If so, what did each say? That's the first question. Why don't you take that one first?
Okay. I'm going to refer this question to Mark Hodgson. Mark, you want to introduce yourself and some of the outreach we've done?
My name is Mark Hodgson. I'm a private attorney in Concord who's been consulting with Northern Pass on road permitting issues for public highways. For 24 years, I was in the Attorney General's office and represented DOT. The question is regarding what a consent decree or memorandum that's been filed in federal court and governs any construction in Franconia Notch. It was part of the litigation surrounding the creation of the Franconia Notch Parkway. And anybody that knows Franconia Notch Parkway knows that it is not your typical interstate design. It is, in fact, very different and goes down to one lane in each direction at one point. And originally, as designed, it wasn't even divided. There wasn't even a barrier there. And that was permitted by the federal government, Federal Highway Administration, back in the 80s. As part of the settlement of the litigation because of the very highly sensitive environmental considerations in the Notch, as well as the cultural considerations. It is really an important area for the state of New Hampshire, for all of us residents. And it might very well be the most environmentally sensitive area in the state. But that litigation specifically says that there shall be no further construction or additional lanes within Franconia Notch. So the question is, have we consulted or sought to change that agreement. And the reason is we're not party to it. DOT is. And I happen to have been representing DOT back in the 90s when they did seek to change that agreement and put in a guardrail between the two lanes. And that process took years to accomplish, simply to put in a guardrail after people had been killed in there. So I am well aware of how difficult that process is. And DOT is not inclined to engage in that process for anything but safety issues. So we know that that is not really a viable opportunity to change that agreement, especially for this project and given some of the other signatories to that agreement, including the Society and the Appalachian Mountain Club. So DOT has no appetite to seek a change. They would have to agree to do so, and that's why we sought alternative routes.
Just stay up here, Mr. Hodgson, because we have two more questions that involve the roads. So
lucky me.
The next one is, have you specifically asked New Hampshire Department of Transportation whether you could use any part of I-93 before you proposed using state roads in Grafton County? If so, what did the Department of Transportation say? If not, why not?
As is typical with this, with any kind of project of this size, we have had ongoing discussions with DOT for at least 3 years. I can't remember how long, actually. And we're, as you might imagine, I'm very familiar with their rules and regulations and their policies. And so we have had extensive discussions with them, and we knew where their preferences and their interests lied, and that's why we proposed the roads we did.
Third question on the sheet is, have you specifically asked New Hampshire DOT whether you could use routes 302, 18, 116, and 112 before you announced this route in August 2015? If so, what did New Hampshire DOT say? If not, why not?
We filed the application requesting that with DOT. It would be inappropriate prior to the filing of the application to ask if we could use those roads. We complied with their criteria as they asked us to do and submitted documents that met their standards and criteria so that we could move forward. They are still reviewing the process. Even today, they haven't said we can use or can't use any particular roads. It would be inappropriate for them to do that. They're reviewing the application. What they've said to date is that everything we submitted allows them to review the application. In other words, it's complete. We chose those roads in part because of our consultations with DOT and knowing their concerns, particularly with I-93 and Franconia Notch.
The next question is really addressed to the SEC, so I'll take a crack at answering it. Has the Site Evaluation Committee done an economic impact study on the potential cost to the state on locating this in I-93 in terms of traffic delays, traffic rerouting, and impacts on tourism? The Site Evaluation Committee up to this point has done no studies at all. The application is filed before the Site Evaluation Committee, and the various studies are normally done by the parties, and the Site Evaluation Committee will consider what studies they are going to rely on, just like a judge in a trial determines what evidence is more persuasive. So the SEC has not done an economic impact study. You may want to address whether the applicant has done one.
We have not.
I'm sorry?
We have not.